A recent photo by Outside Magazine shows a line of 300 climbers on Mount Everest, creating a bottleneck which contributed to the deaths of 4 people. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer. Ben Kiefer is away. This hour, a conversation with the first Iowan to summit Mount Everest, Charlie Whitmack, and Iowa City physician and mountain climber Chuck Huss. We'll talk about the increasing popularity of climbing the world's tallest peak and the implications. Then, a conversation with the world's fastest juggler, Iowan Mark Hansen of Kanawha.
I never thought I'd get into the Guinness Book of World Record for anything, and it's a very prestigious record, being a juggler and an amateur juggler.
That's River to River after the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. About a week ago, a remarkable photo captured by Outside Magazine surfaced. It shows a line of about 300 climbers about 4,000 feet from the top of Mount Everest, the world's tallest peak. The line of climbers was creating a so-called bottleneck, which was partially credited with claiming the lives of 4 climbers who were making their way back down the mountain. The Everest climbing season typically runs from late March to the first week of June, and climbing the mountain has become increasingly popular. More people reached the summit on a single day in 2010 than in the 30 years after the first ascent in 1953. Joining me now are 2 people who know Mount Everest well. Chuck Huss is an emergency room physician in Iowa City and accomplished high-altitude climber. He's completed many climbs above 20,000 feet and has reached the tallest point in more than a dozen countries. Chuck has also attempted to summit Everest 4 times, in 1998, 2000, 2003, and 2005. Chuck Huss joins me now in our studio in Iowa City. Welcome.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Also joining me by phone is Charlie Whitmack. Charlie is an internationally known adventurer and the first Iowan to summit Mount Everest in 2003. He summited the world's tallest mountain again last year as part of the World Try, which we, of course, documented on this program. It was a remarkable 10,000-mile journey, which included swimming, biking, running, and climbing. Welcome back to the program, Charlie.
Thanks so much.
Charlie, I have to ask, are you fully recovered from your 10,000-mile journey last year?
I am. Yeah, the nice thing about a journey like that when you have so little oxygen at the end on Everest is that once you get the oxygen back, you get back to normal pretty quickly. So I feel terrific. Thanks.
As I mentioned, Charlie, you've summited Mount Everest twice, though about 8 years apart. How do you gauge the growing popularity in climbing the mountain just between the 2 times that you did?
You know, it was the 2 experiences were very different for me. In 2003, I reached the summit. I guess, just been there to climb Mount Everest. That was the purpose of my trip. I made 3 separate summit attempts. I reached the summit in what was at the time the worst recorded history, the worst recorded weather on the mountain. The day I reached the top, I was the only non-Sherpa to come down with all my fingers and toes. The last 2 summit attempts were back-to-back, and it was a very, very difficult day. The day I reached the summit, there was a bottleneck at the Hillary Step, and there were about 40 people that were stuck there. I was one of the first to reach the summit, and so I hit the bottleneck on the way down.
And the Hillary Step, what is that?
The Hillary Step is where the problem started this year. And to climb Everest, you know, you spend about 2 months setting your camps and getting the route in position to get to this highest camp, which we call Camp 4. From Camp 4, then, you're going to spend about maybe 10 to 15 hours climbing up from Camp 2 to what's called the South Summit. Now, the trouble is the South Summit is almost all of the elevation, but to get to the true summit, which is just a few feet higher, you have to climb down this knife-edged ridge. It's very exposed, several thousand-foot drop on each side. And in the midst of that ridge is really the biggest challenge of the climb, which is something called the Hillary Step. And for many climbers, to climb up that 70-foot section of rock, it may take them even 45 minutes to an hour. So this is an area where many problems start on Everest. People are severely hypoxic. They're not thinking clearly. They're exhausted from the climb, and they're just focused on that summit. They don't want to give up at that point.
And Chuck, how about you? You've attempted the summit 4 times. How do you gauge maybe the growing popularity of it, or just the number of climbers that were there during your attempts?
Well, its popularity is there because it's the highest peak. You know, I've climbed 500 peaks around the world, and the only one anyone ever asked me about is Everest. To some degree, more people going makes it slightly less difficult and safer, but it reaches a certain point where there's so many people going that it makes it much worse.
Paint me a picture of how the climb actually works. So in this photo, there's 300 climbers, and they're pretty much all next to each other. Is there like a line or a wire that people are attached to that they're climbing up? Paint me a picture of how they're actually ascending and coming back down the mountain.
Yeah, that picture was taken from up near Camp 4, looking down at the fixed rope, a single rope that's attached to the ice that you're climbing on by screws that are drilled into the ice to fix them. And people pull up on those ropes, and there's a single rope, and that's why they're all lined up one behind the other.
Charlie, Chuck mentioned that he summited many mountains, and the only one that people ask about is Mount Everest, and that it is becoming more popular. Why is it becoming more popular, do you think?
Everest is the highest mountain in the world. I think it's a place that everybody wants to be. It's an extraordinary expedition and an extraordinary country, and it, I think, in many ways still represents the pinnacle of human achievement.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it has always been the world's highest peak, so that hasn't changed. Is it that the sport is becoming more popular, or just that people are seeking more of a thrill? Or can we just not pinpoint a cause for why so many more people are trying to summit it?
Oh, I think climbing is certainly a sport that is increasing in popularity. Everest is certainly at the center of that. People go to a mountain like Everest for a lot of different reasons. When I climbed the mountain in 2003, the statistic was for every five people that would reach the summit, one person would die trying. And so it takes an unusual person to take on a challenge of that nature. There are people that are definitely seeking something, and it's never exactly clear what it is that they're seeking. Some are seeking fame and recognition. Some are seeking fortune. Some are seeking to challenge themselves personally. Some are on a spiritual journey. They're climbing to learn more about themselves. Others are doing it to conquer others and to be seen as someone who is somebody who can achieve anything. So all those people are mixed together.
Charlie, what do you think are the implications of just the sheer number of people attempting to climb Everest now?
I'm not opposed to the numbers. There's a lot of climbers that have been climbing for a lot of years, and they're shocked and dismayed by this, but at the same time, they think that they should be the ones to be able to be there. The economic development in Nepal as a result of the increase in climbing is really tremendous. The life expectancy in the region has increased. Maternal mortality rates have decreased significantly. And we're seeing in Nepal now that there is great development, and that's really improving the lives of the people that are there. So I hope people continue to go to Nepal. At the same time, it's setting more responsibility on the individuals that participate. I think if we've seen anything on Everest, it's that the mountain is attracting more climbers who are less qualified. And that's really come along with the increase in guiding on the mountain. There are climbers who are spending over $100,000 to make an attempt on the summit. And it's gotten harder and harder to guide that mountain safely. So if you're an independent climber, as Chuck and I both are, we go to the mountain by ourselves. We create teams of other qualified climbers, and we take care of each other. We look out after each other, and we make sure we have a safe expedition. And frankly, oftentimes, we climb against the current on the mountain. So these big expeditions get involved in groupthink. They start to make bad decisions. They start to make decisions that end up with 300 or 400 people all climbing to the summit on the same day. And we try to stay out of that. And so independent climbers, I think, will continue to have good expeditions on Everest. The guided expeditions will continue to have bigger and bigger challenges. But the real winner here will continue to be Nepal with all this tourism money. And so that's something I'm really excited about.
You mentioned some people spend as much as $100,000 to try the summit. It's expensive to do it, and that's why there's more of an influx of money and development.
That's right. You know, some of the big guides, Russell Bryce, who was featured for years in the, I believe the program was on Discovery, he now charges up to $150,000 for a client. And so most of that money is going back, to Russell. But there is a good deal of money that's being picked up in the lodges and the tea houses and the villages as you head up the mountain, head up to the base of the mountain.
Mm-hmm. And as part of the World Tri last year, you went from Kathmandu to Nepal. Did you notice that transition depending on where you were?
Yeah, you know, Kathmandu is becoming increasingly industrialized, so there is some wealth in Kathmandu, and what I mean by that is there are some people who have a very limited amount of disposable income. As you head out of Kathmandu, you're really in the slums where people are living in a very subsistence way, people that don't have any access to health care. You know, it's about 100 times more likely a woman would die giving birth in this area than she would in the U.S., people who really don't even have the necessary food to eat. And then as you start to head up through the Himalayas and you get closer and closer to Everest, you see that things are becoming more industrialized. There are, of all things, there's a hotel on the way to Everest now that has heated bathroom floors. It's got flush toilets and hot showers. It's in a town called Namche Bazaar. And the individuals that live in this town make about 100 times the GDP, the average GDP for a person in Nepal. So many of the people in this region are sending their children of all places to college in the United Kingdom and in the United States. And these are people who really, I think, are going to have a very active role in the future of Nepal and in leading that country in some difficult times.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Charlie Whitmack, the first Iowan to summit Mount Everest in 2003 and again last year as part of his World Try. I'm also joined by Chuck Huss, an experienced climber and emergency room physician from Iowa City. He's attempted the Mount Everest summit four times. Chuck, you've been a physician on the climbs. You've acted as the medical doctor on these summit attempts. What are some of the medical issues, maybe some of the most common medical issues that people face when they get in such high altitudes?
The body doesn't like to be at high altitude too much, and everyone's response to it is a little bit different. Most everyone who ascends quickly will develop a condition called acute mountain sickness, characterized by a throbbing headache, nausea, dizziness, inability to sleep, sort of grogginess, and less activeness. That can, through some interesting physiologic things, eventually make your brain swell, which can impair your balance first, which is a pretty important thing as you're climbing up a steep mountain, but it can impair your judgment as well and eventually cause you to be comatose and actually have enough swelling to cause death if you stay there too long without treatment. Then there's a third condition called high-altitude pulmonary edema, in which the pressure on the right side of your heart becomes so high that you, instead of being able to assimilate oxygen in your lungs, puts back pressure, and you actually develop fluid developing in the air cells of your lung, and you eventually suffocate. Much like a heart failure patient does.
This is caused by simply ascending too quickly?
The bottom line for all of it is hypoxia, low blood oxygen levels. But it stimulates some reflex changes in the body, both in the lung and the blood vessels and in the brain that are somewhat pathologic in that too much fluid accumulates in the head, your brain swells, too much pressure on the right side of your heart, and you back up fluid into the lungs.
So how does gradually going up or down, how does that maybe help prepare you to accept those different conditions?
Yeah. Anyone transported quickly from 710 feet here in Iowa City to the summit of Mount Everest would die in 15 minutes. But your body has an ability through many, many different organ systems and mechanisms to adapt a process called acclimatization. And through gradually going higher and higher, your body adjusts more red blood cells, deeper breathing, things going on with your kidney, you can actually tolerate that. And something like 150 people have gone to the summit without supplementary oxygen all the way to 29,000 feet. But generally, the people who do well at high altitude, like Charlie, they acclimatize well and quickly and better than lots of other people. It's sort of a inborn talent that you can't really train, but if you have it, it makes you good at high altitude. Mm.
Charlie, how long should an Everest climb take?
Oh, I think the average now is probably about 7 or 8 weeks. the amount of time has gotten shorter as these bigger guided expeditions have really taken over the mountain, and the guides are trying to keep it smaller. They're trying to avoid having people get these other illnesses, not necessarily high altitude pulmonary edema or cerebral edema, but just kind of the cough and gunk that comes from being up high in a mountain in cold temperatures for so long. So the way the mountain is climbed by the big guided expeditions has changed. The clients really don't have to do a lot of the work. You know, they don't set up tents. They don't cook their own food. They don't set any safety lines. And many times they don't even climb up into the higher camps until they're actually on a summit attempt. So it's a little different approach than the way Chuck and I have climbed the mountain in the past.
What kinds of medical issues did you face, Charlie?
You know, I was very fortunate this last year. The first time I climbed the mountain in 2003, I had a little bit of everything. I ended up spending 2 days climbing the mountain blind from snow blindness. This last year, I was very, very fortunate. I'd been on a big expedition. I'd been training and working out very hard for many, many months, and much of that had been at extremely high elevation. And so when I got to the mountain, I was you know, just perfectly tuned for the climb and was very fortunate to be able to make the ascent and what ended up being just about 7 days of actual climbing on the mountain.
And describe this most recent ascent. We of course, spoke about it on this program last year, but briefly, what was that ascent like?
Well, it's just a great example of how independent climbers can still stay out of the riffraff. I was carrying a heavy pack up to the higher camps with the hope of carrying up some tents and food and stoves to Camp 3 and Camp 4. It was the first time I'd been to Camp 3 during the expedition. I got to Camp 3. I was feeling very strong. The conditions to me seemed perfect. So I radioed down to my teammates who were in Camp 2 and down in the base camp, and I said, "How's the weather look? I'm going to go up to Camp 4 and carry this load." And they said, "Oh, no, Charlie." They said, none of the big expeditions are coming up. We're worried there's going to be a storm in the forecast here, and we'd like you to turn around." And I just, you know, I've been climbing for almost 20 years. I looked around, and I saw absolutely no indication of inclement weather. And so I said, "You know, fellas, I'm going to just go up to Camp 4 and have a look and see how it looks." So the next day I climbed to Camp 4. There was absolutely no wind. It was actually a little warm up there. Just totally unprecedented conditions. And so I pitched a tent, and it was the only tent in Camp 4. And so later in the afternoon, another climber came in who was also an independent climber. He was a British man who I think had 8 or 9 ascents of Everest. And so he pitched his tent. He had 2 of his Sherpas with him. And they headed out that night about 10 o'clock at night. And I knew since I was climbing alone, you know, I would have to wait a little longer and make sure no weather came in. And so at 1 o'clock in the morning, I was satisfied that there wasn't going to be a storm or a front. You know, it was a blanket of stars, absolutely no wind. And again, even a little on the warm side, I unzipped my down suit as I walked out of Camp 4. And so then I climbed alone to the summit. I met the other team. They were on their way down, and we kind of gave each other a high five, and they sort of shook their head. You don't see people alone up there very often. I went on to the summit. I spent about 45 minutes on the summit in absolutely perfect conditions.
And as I remember, and I've seen video, you solved the Rubik's Cube there.
Yeah, a big part of the World Triathlon was these 2 humanitarian programs. I worked for an organization called Above and Beyond Cancer, which does cancer advocacy work for organizations including the American Cancer Society. My wife is a cancer survivor. And we also did this humanitarian project for an organization called Save the Children. And so Save the Children wanted something kind of funny to kick off an online fundraising campaign. And so I did a little PSA for them on the summit of Everest, which, right, included solving the Rubik's Cube.
Charlie Whitmack, if you look into a crystal ball, what do you see for the future of Mount Everest climbing? Do you see what you were talking about with more groups climbing it or more individuals climbing it? What do you see going forward here?
I think the popularity of the mountain is going to continue to increase. I think technology will continue to improve that will keep more safe, more climbers safer and allow probably less qualified people to get to the top. I think it'll be a continuation of the same with the experienced climbers. Every year on the mountain, we see some of the most experienced climbers in the world perish, as we see some of the least experienced climbers in the world make it to the top. So I think that irony on the mountain will continue. I think the mountain will become more safe, but I don't see any limitation in the future. I expect more and more people. I don't think the government of Nepal would ever begin to limit the number of people that go to the mountain. They like that money. They need that income. And I think the responsibility will continue to push down to the individuals to make sure when they get there, they need to be qualified, they need to make good decisions, and they need to stay out of this group decision-making in order to have a safe and independent climb.
Chuck, what do you see for the future?
Well, I think the numbers will continue. I agree, Charlie, that the government of Nepal will not limit it at $10,000 a person. You saw in that picture there was about $3 million of income to the Nepalese government just for permits. So that's sort of the startling thought when I looked at that each person's paying $10,000. But I think the government's not going to limit that. That's their huge cash cow. I think the people going will probably go in guided groups. The success rate seems to be slightly higher. You don't have to have as much experience, and your success rate's actually pretty good even without experience.
Do either of you have any upcoming climbing expeditions planned? Start with you, Chuck.
I'm working on four projects. Actually, in 3 weeks, I'm headed for the North Pole. That came up rather suddenly, and an opportunity that I couldn't turn down. But only 2 weeks after I get back from that, I'm going to take my wife to Norway for our 20th anniversary and climb some just nice mellow peaks with her. And then in the winter, our winter, I'm headed to South America to finish off climbing the 10 highest peaks in the Western Hemisphere. I have one peak left.
Mm. And which peak is that?
It's called Casadero in northern Argentina.
Mm. And Charlie, what about any upcoming expeditions that you've planned?
Well, the rest of the year is just working with friends and with clients. And so in June here, we have a team of individuals that will race their bicycles across America as part of the race called RAM. We have a team of 8 cancer survivors and caregivers that will bicycle 3,000 miles in 7 days. So people can follow that at aboveandbeyondcancer.org. And then in July, I'll be climbing with a small group in Russia. August, we'll be back in East Africa climbing on Mount Kenya and Mount Kilimanjaro. September and October, I've got a 3-week expedition to Tibet. And then November is back in the Everest region for a humanitarian project with Save the Children. And then we'll finish the year off. I'm taking my wife and kids down to the Andes. My wife has always wanted to see Machu Picchu, so we've got a small group going down there and taking along a bunch of kids.
Well, good luck to both of you on all of those upcoming trips that you have planned. Thank you so much, Charlie Whitmack and Chuck Huss. Thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.
Dr. Chuck Huss is an experienced climber and emergency room physician from Iowa City. He has summited many peaks higher than 20,000 feet and has attempted to summit Mount Everest 4 times. Charlie Whitmack is the first Iowan to summit Mount Everest in 2003 and again last year as part of the World Tri. They were responding to a recent photo captured by Outside Magazine, which showed a line of about 300 climbers 4,000 feet from the top of Mount Everest. The so-called bottleneck was credited with causing the deaths of 4 climbers who were on their way down the mountain. Coming up, a conversation with the world's fastest juggler, Mark Hansen, from the small town of Kanawha in north central Iowa. It's coming up in just a moment. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer, sitting in for Ben Kiefer.
Ready, set, go.
2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14.
The man featured in this YouTube video is my next guest. His name is Mark Hansen, and he's from Kanawha, a small town of about 650 in north central Iowa, about an hour southwest of Mason City.
2, 4, 6.
In the video, Mark is counting the number of rounds he's passing 3 balls between his hands. It's a video that was just certified by Guinness World Records, making Mark Hansen the world's fastest 3-ball juggler. Welcome to River, Mark.
Well, thanks for having me, Alex.
1 minute of juggling and that many rounds, it is blinding speed. Tell us exactly how many balls you were able to juggle in 1 minute.
I did 417 catches. That's how they measure it. 1 minute, and how you're essentially playing catch with yourself. So I made 417 catches.
And so 417, what was the previous record?
339.
So you not only broke this record, you shattered this record.
Yeah, that's what I keep telling people. I put it on my website. I shattered it. So, yeah.
How does it feel? Does it feel any different to be a world record holder?
Oh, yeah. I was never – I didn't expect to be that fast. I didn't I never thought I'd get into the Guinness Book of World Record for anything. And it's a very prestigious record, being a juggler and an amateur juggler, to shatter a longstanding speed juggling record was, you know, surprising to me as well as everybody else. So,
you said it was longstanding. How long had that record stood?
Well, at least 2 years. And the gentleman, he's from the Czech Republic. He's a professional juggler, escape artist. He had that record for several years, and he had just broken it like 2 years ago. So I don't know. I mean, it was 339, and prior to that, he held it. So, you know, I'm guessing three years.
How are you able to juggle that fast?
Well, over the years, I've been juggling for 40 years. I taught myself in 1970, I think it was. And all the patterns that I juggle, I just perfected. I would see how small I could make the patterns, how fast I could do them, without any intention of becoming the world's fastest juggler. It's kind of by default, actually, just over the years of practice and perfecting the pattern.
Of course, there are different methods of juggling, and I guess that you experimented with different ones?
Yeah, there are literally, for three balls, there are patterns, they're called. There are hundreds of patterns, and I have taught myself at least 50 or 60. I've lost track of how many patterns there are. The standard pattern that beginners learn is called the cascade, and I broke the record with what is called a reverse cascade. And, of course, there's many, many other patterns as well.
How did you get interested in juggling?
Well, I remember I was sitting in my bedroom watching TV. I was bored. I was 16 at the time, and I was watching a Flip Wilson variety show, and he had a juggler on, and she explained carefully how the cascade pattern was done, and I began practicing for hours until I got the hang of it. It probably took me a couple days, and then that's how I taught myself.
And you've been doing this, you said, 40 years?
Mm-hmm.
I assume that it would just take a lot of practice.
It does. After, you know, I was, like I said, I was 16 at the time. I taught myself, and I only knew one pattern. A number of years later, I went into the military, and I was probably 21 years old. I was stationed overseas in the Azores, and the island that I was stationed on was very small, and I was bored, and I was watching TV again, and another juggler came on, and he did probably 8 or 10 tricks, and I watched carefully. I remembered all his tricks, and I taught myself all those tricks while I was on the island. And I practiced 3-4 hours a day then.
So it was something to pass the time then.
Yeah, exactly. It was fun. It was good for me. It really helped my coordination reflexes. And it helped the next season when I played softball. I was actually made the base all-star team. I feel like part of the accomplishment for that was the juggling skills that I learned.
You're out of the military now?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you come back to the States, and you keep practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And then how does your juggling career evolve from that?
Well, I lived in Minneapolis when I came back, and I joined a juggling club there and pursued juggling a little steadier and more on purpose, so to speak. And I did a little bit of performing. I'm not much of a performance fan. I prefer to teach kids how to juggle rather than perform. So over the years, I learned a lot of tricks, but I went to schools or just taught at fairs and festivals, and anybody that would come up to me, I'd teach kids. I've taught hundreds of kids over the years how to juggle, so that's really where I'm at. I'm more of a hobbyist, and I consider myself an amateur and not a professional.
And I understand that your juggling, your performing, is somewhat of a family affair.
Yeah, all my family we all unicycle in parades, and 5 out of the 7 of us can juggle. There's just my youngest can't juggle, and one of my daughters can't juggle.
And so you perform at parades.
Mm-hmm.
Just around your small town of Kanawha, Mason City, where?
Yeah, Kanawha, of course, Britt, Garner, Clemmy, Corwith, just any of the small towns that invite us. Oftentimes, if we have the time, we'll go to their annual event and ride in their parade. And then my wife will face paint, my kids will twist balloons, and I'll teach juggling.
Why do you do that?
just because it's fun. We like to, and oftentimes we do it gratis because I enjoy teaching so much and they like having fun and interaction with the people. We like bringing our skills to these events because they're different. They're unusual.
Mm-hmm. Is this kind of performing unicycle juggling, is that something that your wife was always interested in, or did you kind of bring her into that?
I brought her into it. Mm-hmm. She's glad she did. Now, she's, you know, it took her a while to learn how to unicycle, and, you know, she's still on a lower level of juggling skills, but she's glad that she knows how to do it because now she can help me if we go to school, and she's good enough juggler where she understands how to explain how to juggle. So it really helps us spread out and help more kids at once.
Mm-hmm. With all the practice that you've put forth to break the world record, I don't know, but I can imagine your wife maybe saying sometime, Mark, are you juggling again?
Yeah. She has watched me practice. Since it only takes a minute to practice for the world record, prior to the world record, I probably broke the world record in practice 2,000 times. So when she was at the main event, when I finally did it, she said that she had to conjure up the excitement because it was so anticlimactic to her because she'd seen me do it so many times.
Walk us through that day at the National Guard Armory in Mason City in December of last year when you actually broke the record. What was that day like?
Well, Regan Banks, and it was the North Iowa Youth Center event, and Regan Banks had set it up for me. It was a charity event, and Guinness World Records likes it when you do events like that for charity. And I got there early, and there was a bunch of inflatables and a lot of kids playing around, and I was set up in a corner with an area so that I could teach juggling, and a whole bunch of kids came over throughout the day. I was probably there 2 or 3 hours prior to the record attempt, and I taught a number of kids how to juggle. I was using scarves and balls and so forth. And this one young lady, she actually learned how to juggle. She's one of my fastest students, and she was so excited. So after I broke the world record then, she wanted my autograph and all kinds of things. Anyway, so as the event came up then, I started getting more and more nervous because Regan, there was only so much time before, you know, the event had to end. So he promised me 10 attempts before, you know, he would have to call it quits. So what I did, my first attempt, I told the audience, I'm going to go slow so that I don't drop, so I have the record in the bag, so to speak, and then I'll try to break it several more times. So that's what we did. My first attempt, I did 411 catches, and then I flubbed up a couple times. Then I actually went and did a little worse. I did a 408, a couple more flubs up. I started getting nervous. Then I did a 414. And the very last time I was getting so shaky and wobbly, I had to sit in a chair. So when you see the YouTube video, I'm actually sitting in a chair. That's the last attempt, and that's when I did the 417, and that's when the crowd kind of went crazy.
You say that you were going slow in some of those first attempts, but you going slow was still breaking the world record.
Oh, yeah. Going slow for me is 410. For, you know, anything over 400 was slow for me.
I am not a juggler, but I imagine that there are quite a few amateurs out there who have juggling balls maybe at their house or in their office, and they do that in their free time. What would someone like that expect? How many times would they be able to toss the balls in a minute?
That's a good question. There was a number of websites, of course, picked up the story, and there was a guy in Michigan who has a juggling website, and he had just picked up the story saying that, okay, Mark Hansen did 417 catches. He broke the 339 record, and he said, I grabbed my juggling balls just out of curiosity. Now, this guy juggles. He's been juggling for years, and when he did it, he did 289, and he thought if he was lucky and he practiced a lot, he might be able to break the old record, but he couldn't foresee ever getting over 400. So around 300 and less would be an average juggler's speed, 250 to 275 probably.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Mark Hansen. He is the world's fastest three-ball juggler from the small north central Iowa town of Kanawha. He broke the record in December, but it was just recently certified by Guinness World Records. What kind of balls do you use?
I use professional juggling balls. They're called bean bags. They're hand sewn. The ones that I used are slightly smaller than a standard size. There's many different sizes. There's stage ball size, or and then smaller. These are probably two-thirds the size of a baseball, and they're made out of fabric, and they're filled with bird seed, and the ones that I have are pretty soft, probably because I've dropped them so many times over the years. But the reason why I like the fabric and the softness of them is because when I'm juggling my pattern, the pattern is so small, the balls at times actually graze each other. And if the balls are too hard, like, for instance, if I was juggling golf balls and they grazed each other, they would ricochet, and then the pattern would collapse. Whereas these balls, because they're soft, they could absorb a little bit of impact and allow me to juggle a pattern smaller. Obviously, smaller balls, you can juggle the pattern smaller.
Are these balls that you made yourself?
No, you can buy them online. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And are they expensive?
Well, they can be $8 and up a piece.
But I guess worth it now that you're a world record holder.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're well worth it. Exactly. Maybe I should come out with a line of Mark Hansen juggling balls.
Maybe. What was the process like of getting certified? There was several months delay until when Guinness World Records certified the record. What was that process like of actually having this record certified?
Well, what you do is you go online, you go to the Guinness World Records website, and you set up an account. It's free. And then you explore the records that you're interested in. Obviously, I was interested in that speed ball juggling record. And you apply for that record. And I say, I want to break that record. You give the name, address, the whole nine yards of the account, where you want to, the event, whether it's a charity, the people that are involved, your witnesses, how much you're going to deal with media, like if you can bring in TV, radio, newspapers, and they want all that information up front. And then after you set your account up and you apply for the record, it can be up to 6 to 8 weeks before they respond and say that you can break the record. Now, a lot of people may break Guinness World Records on the side, but Guinness will not certify it unless you actually go through them.
Mm-hmm. What's the value in having a record certified?
Well, the value is, as a lot of people, one of my witnesses was Mayor Eric Buchmeyer from Mason City. And after I broke the record, he says, you know, out of all the world records there are, there's like Olympic records and then there's Guinness World Records. He says Guinness World Records is the gold standard of world records. The name itself is so prestigious that it gives you bragging rights for the rest of your life. You can say that I'm in the Guinness World Records and I am certifiably the fastest juggler in the world. You know, I can prove it. In my case, wanting to, say, get into schools and teach kids how to juggle, if I say that I am in the Guinness World Record book, I am the fastest juggler in the world, that has a lot of clout.
Mark Hansen, what advice would you give to new jugglers or someone who has never tried to juggle before?
Well, I would say any athlete, anybody like softball, baseball players, football, basketball, anybody that has to have eye-to-hand coordination, good reflexes, it improves your peripheral vision, spatial awareness, rhythm, and things like that. There's a lot of benefits to athletes in particular. They've also discovered over the years that children with some learning disabilities, like they have attention deficit syndrome or things like that, juggling is amazingly helpful for them. So, you know, it's not as hard as people think. I mean, I taught myself. I'm not a natural juggler by any means. Every trick that I've learned was difficult. You just can't be afraid to drop or to fail. That's part of the process of learning how to juggle. Just stick with it. You can go online now. It's so easy to find how-to juggling videos, and there's lots of really good ones on YouTube. And just watch the demonstration and just practice, and you'll be surprised at how fast you can learn how to juggle.
Mark, there's a saying that records are made to be broken, and I understand that you are going to attempt to break your own record.
Yep, I just applied again. I'm still in the waiting process. I've been practicing with a new pattern, and I'm pretty sure that Guinness is going to accept that pattern. And if they do, I think I'm not going to tell you a number, but it's significantly higher than where I the record that I broke previously, I think people will be surprised again by how much fast. I'm, again, surprised by how fast this one is going to be, too.
Mark Hansen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer. Joining me now is Kim Partrick. She is a records manager at Guinness World Records. She certifies and reviews record-breaking attempts. Welcome to the program, Kim.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
So we just spoke with Mark Hansen about how he shattered the world record in three-ball juggling. Describe what that process is like, trying to break a world record, something like what we just heard from Mark Hansen, the three-ball juggling.
Well, when a person would like to break a Guinness World Record and they receive the guidelines from us, we have a lot of strict requirements, including for this category. So we need to review all of the evidence to make sure that we watch the attempt and confirm from the statements from independent witnesses that all the guidelines were followed, that the record really was broken, and then we ourselves also adjudicate the video, which was what took place with this record. We had to watch the video over and over to count the specific number of catches to make sure we got it right. And it turns out he did just shatter this record. It was 339, and he did 417, which is incredible.
So is it pretty much the same amount of documentation required for any world record-breaking attempt, or does it depend on what the record you're trying to break is?
It really depends on the record. I mean, a lot of them are pretty standard, like these one-minute attempts. We definitely need the video. A lot of times we ask for it in slow motion as well, along with the witness statements. Something like that is much less information you have to send in because it's easy for us to watch the video and adjudicate. There are other cases, such as a record that involves, say, the most nationalities to do the same thing at the same time. In those cases, we have to see copies of every person's passport that takes part to verify their nationality, as well as for mass participation attempts, which I personally am in charge of. We ask for a lot of evidence when it comes to the counting. Depending on what the process is, we may need to see tickets. We may need to see additional statements from the people counting. It really depends on the category, but we are very strict in our evidence requirements.
Some of the latest records that I saw on the website were the largest collection of Charlie's Angels memorabilia, the largest collection of film projectors, and the loudest purr by a domestic cat. It seems that there could be a record for just about anything. How is it chosen what the categories are?
Well, before we consider any new application, we look for a few key points. Something definitely needs to be, first of all, definable and standardizable worldwide and across attempts. So we have to make sure that it's an activity we can really define. Also, it needs to be measurable. So something that's subjective, such as the best artist or something like that, is not something that we could evaluate on any objective level. So we need to make sure we can get an accurate number. And also, we need to make sure that it's verifiable. So it may be measurable, but we have to make sure that it can be actually proven how many was achieved, how much was achieved. And lastly, if it ticks all of those boxes, we look at the activity itself and see if it's something that would be of interest and applicable worldwide.
I remember paging through Guinness World Records books as a kid, just being amazed at some of the records and some of the photos. Why do you think people are so fascinated with these records?
Well, all Guinness World Records are really, what's great about them is that they are superlative in their category. So it's bigger, it's larger, it's greater than anything you've ever seen in that genre before. So yes, for example, we've seen, you know, small amounts of, say, Charlie's Angels memorabilia, but to see all of it conglomerated together in one picture with the person who's really enthusiastic about it, it just resounds a lot with everyone around the world because they can see really the best and the greatest in whatever they're interested in.
I asked juggler Mark Hansen what he thought about the value of having a Guinness World Record, having the title of it, and he said that in a way it gives him clout and a platform to say that he is the world's fastest juggler, and it helps him when he goes to schools to teach children about juggling. What is the value of having a Guinness World Record?
Well, along with personal pride, it's basically the fact that you can say that you're the best in the world at whatever it is that you're good at. And as you mentioned, we recognize categories all over the board. So everyone has something that they're proud of and that they're good at. And what Guinness World Records does is it gives them the chance to develop that skill and become truly recognized as the greatest in the world at whatever it is.
Working for Guinness World Records, what are some of the most common questions that you get from friends, family? What do people want to know about the work that you do?
probably the most common question I get is, what's the craziest record adjudication that you've been to, or what's your favorite? And that is such a hard question to ask, because every single event that I go to really is surprising and special in its own way. So it's a great privilege to work here and to get to see so many different things, but I know it sounds cliche, but I just can't pick a favorite.
Kim Partrick, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Kim Partrick is a records manager at Guinness World Records. To see a video of Mark Hansen of Onawa shatter the world record as the fastest three-ball juggler, you can visit our Facebook page. Just look for Iowa Public Radio. Technical support today from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer. Thanks for joining us.